Over the past few weeks, we've been looking at stories in the New Testament that involve Jesus and tables, specifically context in which he is sitting at a table or preparing to be with people at a table. In these stories, we've observed sometimes what Jesus has taught while being at the table. Other times, we've kind of borne witness to something Jesus did while at the table. Observing both of these things, what someone teaches and what someone does, can really help us to learn a lot about someone in this situation, help us understanding God's heart, because Jesus is God in the flesh. This morning, though, we're not going to focus on Jesus' actions in the story, and we aren't even going to really focus on Jesus' teaching. Instead, we're going to look at something Jesus celebrates, something Jesus affirms in someone else's actions. By hearing what Jesus celebrates, we get another idea of what is really important to God. But before we get to the story, I want to spend a bit of time talking about peace. In our Anabaptist tradition, we've begun before I was in this tradition, but honoring the Sunday before Remembrance Day as Peace Sunday. Remembrance Day was introduced in 1919, following the Great War, as a means of commemorating the end of that war, and in the words of King George V at the time, it was a way to perpetuate the memory of those who laid down their lives to achieve it. Our church is a part of a community of churches that's often collectively referred to as historic peace churches. Members of historic peace churches historically have sought to work in our nation, in relationship with our nation, particularly in times of war, to support a flourishing society while not picking up arms to kill an enemy. That hasn't been done naively. It hasn't been done without struggle, individual personal struggles and collective struggles. And those of us who hold to a peace view, which if you're visiting this morning, this is not even everyone who's a member of this church, but those of us who hold to the peace view don't try to disrespect those who have served or those who have military service or those who have laid down their lives for the sake of another. We affirm with Jesus that greater love has no one than this, than to lay down one's life for one's friends. But on this Sunday before Remembrance Day, we want to remind ourselves that peace is not primarily found in not shooting our enemies or restraining aggressors or even in the absence of war. Peace, true peace, is much more than that. The Hebrew word that we often translate as peace is the word shalom. And while violence and conflict, they do break shalom, there's much more to shalom than just not nonviolence. Theologian Cornelius Platinga Jr. Said this. He's describing shalom. He said, "The webbing together of God, humans, and all creation in justice, fulfillment, and delight is what Hebrew prophets called shalom." We call it peace, but it means far more than a mere peace of mind or a ceasefire between enemies. In the Bible, shalom means universal flourishing, wholeness and delight, a rich state of affairs in which natural needs are satisfied and natural gifts are fruitfully employed, a state of affairs that inspires joyous wonder as its creator and savior opens doors and welcomes the creatures in whom he delights. Shalom, in other words, is the way things ought to be. I love that. It's the way things are supposed to be. That's what true peace is. In a word, we might say shalom is rightness in the world. The world we live in is broken in so many ways, whether it is the violence of wars or political campaigns or family disputes. It doesn't take much to see that shalom, well, it's not the best way to describe the world we live in right now. Things are not the way they ought to be. They aren't right. And that, I think, helps us set the stage for the story we're going to read today from Luke 19. you have your Bibles and you want to turn there, you can. Luke 19, it'll also be on the screen. Luke 19, verses 1 to 10. Jesus entered Jericho and made his way through the town. There was a man there named Zacchaeus. He was the chief tax collector in the region, and he had become very rich. He tried to get a look at Jesus, but he was too short to see over the crowd. So he ran ahead and climbed a sycamore fig tree beside the road, for Jesus was going to pass that way. When Jesus came by, he looked up at Zacchaeus and called him by name. "Zacchaeus," he said, "quick, come down. I must be a guest in your home today." Zacchaeus quickly climbed down and took Jesus to his house in great excitement and joy, but the people were displeased. "He has gone to be the guest of a notorious sinner," they grumbled. Meanwhile, Zacchaeus stood before the Lord and said, "I will give half my wealth to the poor, Lord, and if I've cheated people on their taxes, I will give them back four times as much." Jesus responded, "Salvation has come to this home today, for this man has shown himself to be a true son of Abraham. For the Son of Man came to seek and save those who are lost." In the story, we have Zacchaeus. As a tax collector, he's working for the occupying enemy, this Roman Empire. Not only that, he's getting rich by working for them and exploiting his people. He is actively working against shalom, rightness in the world. In response, he gets ostracized and hated by his community. In response to his working against shalom, his community really pushes him away, doing more harm to potential shalom. Jesus comes along and does something very simple. He invites himself to Zacchaeus' home for a meal. He responds to this breaker of shalom by extending what in the ancient Near East might rightly be called an olive branch. And man, did the people get upset. There's no way a respectable rabbi should be sitting down at a table with a sinner, someone who so clearly fosters wrongdoing like Zacchaeus. And yet, Jesus does. In this story, we have no idea what else Jesus says to him, what else Jesus does beyond ignoring the complaining crowd and going to Zacchaeus' home as his guest. What we do witness is Zacchaeus' response to the presence of Jesus. He says, "I will give half my wealth to the poor, Lord, and if I've cheated people on their taxes, I will give them back four times as much." There is no indication in this that Jesus talks to him about being a tax collector or the harm he's been doing. It appears that Zacchaeus was very aware of the lack of shalom in his life and in his world. But it's kind of amazing that Zacchaeus doesn't just commit to not breaking shalom beyond this. He makes a clear commitment towards fixing it, towards making things the way they ought to be. He's going to need to work towards it, but he's going to do his part to rebuild and foster shalom. And he does that in two ways. One, as you see on the screen, he does it personally. With those he has wronged, he commits to paying back people he has cheated with four times the amount he took from them. That's a deep commitment to shalom, to say, "I'm going to go beyond what would be expected and pay four times the amount." Beyond that, he commits to pursuing shalom societally by giving half of his wealth to the poor. The poor, those disproportionately affected when shalom gets broken. He's like, "I'm going to do it myself, and I'm going to do it for the world around me." And here's where we see the heart of God and how Jesus celebrates Zacchaeus' commitment. Jesus says, "Salvation has come to this home today, for this man has shown himself to be a true son of Abraham, for the Son of Man came to seek and save those who are lost." It's really quickly highlighting three things in Jesus' response. First, Jesus says salvation has come to this home, to Zacchaeus' home, through his commitment to shalom. It's kind of crazy because Zacchaeus already had most of the things our world says you should get and will give you peace. He had the money. He had a position. He had status. I mean, not everyone liked him, but maybe that's the price of getting ahead, right? As I read it, I think it would make sense for Jesus to say, hey, salvation has come to those people that you've robbed. Or salvation has come to the poor who are going to benefit from your generosity. But that's not what he says. He says salvation has come to Zacchaeus' home. You see, what Zacchaeus had, his status, his wealth, it came at the cost of shalom in his own life. And it was by giving those things up, not just stopping the harm being done, but by working to make things right, that salvation comes into his life. Now, that gets extended towards the life of others, but it starts with him. A second thing Jesus does here is affirm something about Zacchaeus that others around him want to deny, and that is his participation in the people of God. When Zacchaeus took his role as a tax collector and he starts cheating people, he is working against shalom. So the people around him, they wanted to exclude him from being a true part of their people, the people of God. He was a sinner that would have been shunned. He is, in their language, not a true son of Abraham. He's given that up for the sake of sin. But when he takes steps to build shalom, Jesus doesn't say he is a son of Abraham again. Jesus goes further and says that he's shown himself to be a true son of Abraham. And he's actually setting Zacchaeus up in contrast to the gatekeepers who were sitting in judgment of him and pushing him away. You know, those gatekeepers were right that Zacchaeus had been breaking shalom, but they also weren't doing anything to try and foster it and rebuild it. Jesus is, in a sense, questioning their claim to be the ones in the right. By celebrating Zacchaeus in this way, he's showing that God's heart isn't just about not breaking shalom. It's about doing the work to build it back up. That's what it looks like for those in God's family to embody God's way in the world, is to that they join in this peacemaking work. And Jesus concludes this by affirming that he, as the Son of Man, didn't just come to stop people from getting off track. He came to rescue the lost, to bring people back to that place of rightness and shalom. So what does this have to do with us today? As we try to be Jesus-like people, people who are a part of God's family, living out God's way in the world, we are to join God in this reconciling, peacemaking work. We're called to join God in large and small ways in helping restore the world to the way it ought to be. On this Peace Sunday, we want our remembrance to lead us to more than just remembering those who have laid down their lives in violent conflict. We do that, but we want to do more than that. We want to recognize that peacekeeping isn't the ultimate work for a Jesus follower. Peacemaking is. To help us think about that, we're going to actually celebrate some of the ways this community has sought and is seeking to do it. Sometimes we think about, you know, well, yeah, we did that, but we kind of lose sight of just how deep and significant it is. One of the things we did shortly after my family arrived here, in fact, the process had already started before we got here, was we sponsored a family of Syrian refugees to come to Canada. And then you raised enough money to sponsor two more of their family members to join them. This isn't just an act of compassion. It's an act of shalom building. And so Elise is going to come and just share some of what's happened over the last 9 years. Man, yeah. It's hard to believe. Do you want to sit here? Or do you want to just stand? Absolutely. Absolutely. Here you go. You can set it wherever you need it.
There we here we are. Okay. So it was 9 years ago, right at this time, when we were like in the thick of preparing for the arrival of this family of refugees from Syria that we had sponsored through a federal government program and the Mennonite Central Committee. And our sponsored family, the Hurias, they arrived on December 31st, New Year's Eve, 2015. Who remembers that time? Yeah, all that furniture and clothing and stuff being collected here. Ahmed and Iman are the parents of the family. When they arrived, Lana was 12 and Abed was 14. For that first year and then some, Covenant supported the family both financially and socially, helping them to orient to their life here in Canada. Fast forward 7 years, and Covenant rose to the challenge once again. We were able to sponsor Muna, that's Iman's mother, and Manar, that's her younger sister. And they came from a refugee camp in Lebanon. As in our first round of sponsorship, we committed to supporting them financially for the first year, but the work of orienting them to life in Canada really was covered by Iman and the rest of the family, as they were already well established here. And like parenthood, the goal of sponsorship is to foster independence. And I think we can say that that goal has been achieved. But as in parenthood, it doesn't mean that we don't stop carrying a concern for one another and we're not interested in what's going on in each other's lives. So we thought it was time for a wee update on what's going on in the Hurria family. So Iman had hoped to be here today to tell you herself, but she had to work. And so I emailed her some questions. And what I'm telling you now are her answers. So today the family lives in a comfortable home, still here in Penetang. It's not the original home that we had rented for them over on Jennings, but it's a nicer home. Iman works part-time at Waypoint in dietary services, and she is studying in food and nutrition management through Sir Stanford Fleming College. Ahmed is still unable to work because of mobility issues that he suffered or that he is experiencing as a result of a stroke that he had while still in Syria. Abed, now in his mid-20s, that little boy, yeah. He's in his fourth year at the University of Guelph in biological science. Lana had been working in dietary services at a local retirement home, but she's now studying full-time and hopes to find work in a medical office. Manar has a degree in agricultural engineering from the University of Damascus. She spent about a year working in dietary services at a retirement home here in the local area. But she recently left that job, hoping to concentrate on improving her English in order to find work that is more in line with her field of study. Muna, the matriarch of the family, she works at looking after the rest of the family from home. Iman says that adjusting to life in Canada has been easy, especially when compared to the difficult situation in Lebanon. The main challenges for the family have been the high cost of living. What we gave them as part of our sponsorship wasn't a great deal, but they have managed very well. And the other challenge has been the difficulty that Manar has had in finding suitable work for her and the overcoming her language challenges. Everyone speaks English except Muna. They speak Arabic at home. Iman, Manar, Lana, and Abed all have driver's licenses, and the family owns two cars. Iman, Abed, and Lana received their Canadian citizenship in 2020, and Ahmed a few years later. Muna and Manar are planning on applying for citizenship very soon. When Muna and Manar came to Canada, they had to leave behind the youngest family member, their youngest, Muna's youngest son, Aham. Twice, Covenant tried to sponsor him to come to Canada. Twice, he was denied by Canadian immigration. And he had to remain in Lebanon, where, if you've been following the news at all, the situation has just become more and more dire and dangerous. Well, earlier this year, after several thwarted attempts, Aham was able to make his way to Libya, of all places, the safe country. And then he crossed the Mediterranean Sea to Italy in one of those awful migrant boats that we see in the news. And without any documentation, he made his way from Italy to Germany, where there was some family members waiting for him. And that's where he is today. And his story certainly puts a face and a name on the news reports about migrants. Really makes me aware of my privilege. Yeah. So here's a bit of good news in all this. A few months ago, Lana and Manar, the former refugees, traveled to Germany as tourists to visit Aham. And I think that's just wonderful. Yeah. Iman is in daily contact with her family in Lebanon and Syria. She says it's not always easy, but keeping these connections alive gives her a sense of comfort despite the difference. So I asked Iman, what would you like us to know about Syria? She said she wants us to know that Syria is a country of rich culture, an ancient history, and warm, welcoming people. She says she misses the peaceful days when life felt safe and neighborhoods were full of laughter and connection. I then asked, what would you like us to know about interacting with people from different cultures? She said it's important to show respect for their cultural and religious traditions and their strong family ties. And be aware that political discussions can be sensitive, so approach conversations with openness and curiosity. And she finished our conversation by saying, I would like to express my heartfelt thanks to all our dear friends at the church for your kindness, support, and continued care for my family. Your thoughtfulness and generosity have made such a difference in our lives, and we are truly grateful for each of you. Thank you for being a blessing to us. And I can say personally that my awareness, my appreciation of the plight of refugees has just expanded a thousandfold through this relationship. Like migrants and refugees are no longer faceless and nameless. They're all Imans and Manars and Ahams.
Thanks, Elise. This is a part of peacemaking work. By joining in God's shalom-building work in the world, as you said, you've learned a lot. I would say salvation has come to this house through what we sought to extend. God has used this to deepen our trust in God, to increase our love for our neighbor. You know, we got into this thinking about what we could offer a family. And by God's grace, that has happened. But by participating in it, God has fostered shalom, rightness among us too. This is also a part of what we're trying to foster with our connection with this Cuban church. I realized this week that we've been talking about the people who are going, and we've been kind of generally referencing this church in Cuba. But many of you haven't met them and haven't shared too much specifically about our brothers and sisters there. And so it very, 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 very quickly, I want to just throw some pictures up on the screen that will maybe show you a little bit more of the actual people that we're connecting with. So first of all, Santa Clara, if you go to the next slide, big slide of Cuba. There should be a big one of like all of Cuba. So I can show where it is. Anyway, it's in the middle. I must have not put them in there. Sorry about that. So Santa Clara is right in the middle of Cuba. And then you've got you can't really see it very well up there, but there's a ring road around Santa Clara, and then to the northeast, outside of the ring road, there's a university there, and the church is in that university neighborhood. They meet in an addition that's attached to the pastor's house. I think we've got a picture of that. Go back to the other one. Yeah, so the left wall there, the white wall, that is the outside wall of the pastor's house. And when that garage door at the back there is open, so is the church, so is the pastor's home. This space serves for counseling, delivery of aid, a ministry center, a gathering for church services, a community hub where people can find a meal or just a cup of coffee. The next slide there. Yeah, among the tools that they have is this three-wheeled car. It's got like a motorcycle, like a motorcycle thing on the inside at the front. And when we were first planning a trip there this fall, we were going to work with the church to fund and install a concrete floor where it's just a dirt floor right now. Then the batteries in their electric vehicle were dying. It wasn't serving them very well. So in September, we asked, and you provided funds to purchase a massive super-powered gas motor for the vehicle. a lawnmower or go-kart kind of engine. And it doesn't look like much to us, but that makes a world of difference for them. In their family and in their church, there have been a bunch of people who have been in the hospital recently. And I showed that they're kind of outside the ring road. The hospital is inside the ring road. And so it takes a bit of a journey. You know, it's like the slower the vehicle, the longer it takes for them to get there. But with this, they can actually get to and from the hospital. It's been transformative for them. 2 weeks ago, I received another picture from the pastor there. And inspired by our generosity to help him get this, they sacrificially gave. As a church, they took up a collection and they bought, well, they call it gravel. It looks more like rubble. But this is going to be the base for where they eventually put a concrete floor, which they will eventually put tile on. And so they sacrificially took up this in the midst of their struggles to be able to do this and spent a bunch of time working and they're breaking it down and putting it in. And our partnership with them is part of what encouraged them and led for them to do that. But this isn't even the main thing about the church. The people are, and I look at this and I see people that I know that are working hard to be able to help create the space for children in their community to find laughter, hope, hear the invitation of Jesus. I think we got a couple of pictures of kids programs there. As much as they can, they try to create space in the community to invite kids, and so that's one of the things our team is going to be doing with them, putting on programs like this in that space. The church is a gathering for university students, and as much as they can, they bring them in and they serve them food because that always gets university students to come. But even at times when the pastor and his family have been struggling for food, they will collect money and try and serve the university students that are there. While I'm mentioning food, they love food. Food is a struggle, but I once asked the bishop's wife, like, how often when you get together for church stuff, do you have food? And she said, oh, if it's available, it will be there. Like, every time we get together, there will be food. This is a picture of the pastor in the reddish-pink shirt, Isbel, and a young man in his mid-20s who he is mentoring, both with food and spiritually. Isbel, I should say, used to run all of the food services at the university before he left and went into ministry full-time. He's mentoring Isbel. This is them cooking some freshly purchased pork over the fire when my family was there in March. Isbel, by the way, a single guy in his 20s who is being mentored and discipled at the church, he is also our built-in translator. Why we can make trips without having to arrange denominationally with someone to come. Luibus learned English by watching movies and listening to English music and then practicing in front of a mirror. When I was there a year ago, he translated while I preached. Again, he's a big part of why this partnership can happen. This isn't just about us taking resources. It's about us building relationships. I think we got another picture there of our family with a bunch of them. But building relationships with Isbel and Madai, the pastor and his wife, who are bottom right corner there. Their daughter is beside them, who is 15 now. With Yonkiel and Siley, who are in there. I can show you later if you want. But they're some of the young leaders of the church who live in a house across the road. With Unisbel and Edeni, who are both in this this picture, who just had a son who's 3 months old, and she's been struggling with a hernia post C-section and struggling to get the resources to even be able to have a repair surgery. It's about getting to know them and walking that road with them with all the fears that new parents have. Luidvis, who's in the top left there beside Micah. He's growing in his relationship with God. He desperately wants to be used to serve the church and his community. This connection isn't really all about a missions trip or trips. It's about partnering with God in pursuing shalom in a place where things are definitely not as they should be. And finding that as we do, salvation comes to our house as well. Mennonite Central Committee makes some of these pins that some of us wear around Remembrance Day. They say, to remember is to work for peace. We do have some of these available in the lobby if you want them in French and English. But as we as a church are trying to create space for people to be beloved, to belong, and become what God has made us to be, our goal is not to grow as a church, to be bigger. We're trying to foster shalom, to join God in working for peace in this world. When Brent and his team of volunteers give up their Wednesday nights and the next Wednesday night and the next Wednesday night and the Saturday and the Friday night, you get my point. It's out of a desire to help youth learn the ways of a God who loves them and invites them into the full life he offers. It's about trying to build shalom. When our teams serve meals on Thursdays or connect with Water Street, it is about trying to build shalom. Your life is about trying to build shalom. And I'm not saying this to try and get you to do something more. It's to celebrate the work that you're doing and to put it into perspective. Whether somebody is serving as a medical professional or cleaning a house or just greeting a neighbor. These are shalom building things, helping to build rightness in a world that is so broken. When you serve with love in the places you volunteer and work and live, you are joining God in this peacemaking work. In our violent world, it's easy to get our eyes focused on the hard stuff that's happening. But our desire is to keep our eyes on what God is inviting us to do. We remember and we work for peace. So hear Jesus celebrate this work among us. Hear him celebrate the peacemaking work that you're doing in your life. It's in these ways, in these places, where we find God's salvation coming to our house today. God, thank you that you are doing a work among us and that we get to partner in helping move things closer to the way they're supposed to be. And it can be so tiring because it seems like there's constant work to break things apart again. God, help us to not grow weary in doing good and to keep stepping forward and doing this work in the world. Help us to celebrate where we see it happening. Help us to celebrate where we see each other doing it, that we would encourage each other and spur each other on to love and good deeds. In Jesus' name, amen.